Hey guys, welcome back to the goddamn thing. I mean, from yesterday. Sorry, I didn't mean to say back. I mean, welcome to the show for the first time all day today. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I say what all libertarians think about foreign policy. All libertarians agree with me 100% about all foreign policies. And if they don't, then they're not libertarians. And I get to decide that. Isn't that cool? That's the deal. It's a real easy litmus test. We're against everything. Foreign policy, we should not have one. Swiss neutrality, that's the model, as long as we even have a nation state at all, which we shouldn't, because what is this, communism? From each according to his ability, to each according to his security needs. How about we just have freedom instead? It makes more sense to me, but I don't know. Anyway, so that's the show. And there's a bias. I don't believe them. And none of their excuses are good enough. Ever. I'm against them. Always. So, that's it. If that's what you want to hear, then you're in the right place. All right. So today on the show, Bob Higgs is going to be here. He's going to explain some reasons to oppose the state. He's got some real good ones. He's Robert Higgs. If you're not familiar, he's the guy that wrote Crisis and Leviathan. And also Against Leviathan. And also Against the War, or wait, no, the, what is it, the Riot, wait. There's so damn many of them, I can't. Delusions of Power, that's one. The Rise of the Re-Rise, what was it? The Return of the Military-Industrial Complex, something like that? The Resurgence of the Warfare State. See, it was in there, I just had to get my synonyms in the proper order. It's like a slot machine, right? The words spinning on their dial. Resurgence of the Warfare State, many other great books. Austrian economist, anarchist libertarian, elder statesman of our movement. And I don't mean statesman, state destroyer of our movement. The great Robert Higgs. He will be on the show today. And also our good friend Ray McGovern. Now, he's former CIA, which is problematic. But I like him. I think he's a good guy, and I think he's really honest. And I asked him if he would come on the show today and talk about Russia and Ukraine and America and Europe and Ukraine. And he said, yes, he would. So I'm very grateful for that because he's a real expert on Russia. That was his expertise back in the days of the Cold War as a CIA analyst. He was not a throat-slitting spy. He was a guy who was taking the information from the throat-slitting spies and, you know, decoding it all and sending it up the chain of command. Anyway, he knows all about Russia. He knows all about the history of America and Russia. And he knows all about Ukraine and America's intervention there as well, and he's really good on it. And so, yeah, the great Ray McGovern. Okay, that's pretty good. Also today, right after this show is over, kind of nervous, I'm going to be debating Walter Block on the Tom Woods Show. I don't think he asked me to not say that or anything, did he? If that was supposed to be a surprise, Tom, I'm sorry. There's like a faint shadow of an echo of a neuron saying that I wasn't supposed to say that, but it doesn't seem right. But maybe that little electrical signal knows what it's talking about. Anyway, so that'll be on the show tomorrow, on Tom's show tomorrow, my debate with Walter Block. Now, Walter Block, like Bob Higgs, is a world-renowned Austrian economist, anarchist, abolitionist of the state, just like Higgs. And I think they differ quite a bit, though, on the pragmatism of working with the state. Robert Higgs once told me he didn't even want to see Dick Cheney prosecuted because that would, you know, necessitate the existence of the Department of Justice. And he would like to see the Department of Justice abolished way before it had a chance to put Dick Cheney in prison for the things that he did and the laws that he broke. So just forget it. Better Cheney go free than the U.S. government continue to exist for one more day. That's pretty much my position, man. I mean, I'm wishy-washy because, you know, what the hell. hold the state to its own standard is what I like to do. But I am as anarchist as Higgs on that. But then, so Walter Block says there's nothing wrong whatsoever with participation in politics, even, you know, celebrating the gain of half a loaf instead of the whole loaf, as they say. I'm a very all-or-nothing kind of guy, you know? So I think Walter and I, we kind of come at this from different angles in the first place. But then also I think that Walter probably gives Rand too much credit. But anyway, I don't think I'm going to really try to convince Walter as much as I'm just going to state my case. And you know, I'm really starting to regret the fact that now I'm like known as the guy who's always talking bad about Rand and whatever, because I'm over it. You know what? I honestly, I know it's stupid. You can make fun of me if you want. But I really was holding out hope that in the first debate that he would come out there and that it would be a new day. Somehow he would get it through his thick freaking skull that his Ron impression is what we all want to hear, dude. But so, nope. If he didn't learn it by now, he ain't gonna change. He's just not. There is no secret Ron under there. That's who Rand is, and he ain't gonna get better. He's going to only get worse. He used to be a bit better. I concede that, but I'm just over it. I want to be over it because I'm tired of having hope and then having being disappointed over and over again. It's driving me crazy, honestly. And anyway, I'm not the anti-Rand guy. I'm the anti-war guy. And part of my problem with Rand is that he's not. But as far as, you know, my priorities in the world, this is the least of them. Well, it's not the least, because, you know, it's important that people know that there are libertarians who are not putting up with this. Who will not concede that, yeah, this is what we stand for, when it's not. So it is important. But also, it's, you know, I mean, I guess same as the war. Kind of have to. But the wars are, you know, obviously. Yeah. Anyway, so Tom Woods, Walter Block. Tom Woods show tomorrow. It'll be me and Walter in our debate. All right. Now, Trump. I got to talk about Donald Trump. What time is it? Okay, well, I only got a few minutes to talk about that. So, well, I guess I'll save that. You know what? I'm going to talk about Trump and Sanders in the next segment. I've been ignoring Trump because that guy's such a freaking clown. Everyone is coming out against him. The entire establishment is piling on him, too. I mean, I hate the guy's guts. I'll get into it. But I guess I sort of felt like it wasn't necessary. You know, like, were y'all waiting for me to comment on Trump? Did you want to know what I okay. I'll tell you what I got to say about him and Bernie Sanders and some other things on the other side of this break. But now let me just tell you this real quick about the wars and the foreign policies and stuff. You know who I love? David Stockman. David Stockman. Now, he's Reagan's former budget director. But I have learned that he was against Vietnam all along. I think he was kind of raised a little bit liberal, but he was never a neocon, like, you know, left the Democrats to join the Republicans because he was a war hawk. That's who the neocons are. He was, you know, he's a budget guy. He's a Wall Street guy. Anyway, so I think he's just getting more and more and more libertarian and also more and more Austrian in his outlook. And he's so freaking smart, dude. Remember I keep telling you that the greatest essay that anybody ever wrote about anything is by him? It's got a real clunky title. It's like Woodrow Wilson and Keynesian Myths and something. Chat room guys, would you help me find it real quick if you're there? Anybody? Keynesian Myths, Central Planning, World War One. David Stockman, it's really long. And he's written the same kind of thing a few different times. So you got to really look around to find. It's always hard to find. But anyway, it's the greatest essay ever. But what I'm talking about here is his most recent essay. I think it might be on antiwar.com today, is it? Or it was yesterday. We ran it yesterday. No, it's the spotlight today on antiwar.com. The Aspen War Games, No Place for Old Peaceniks. Read this man. Understand what he says. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org. Hey, all, Scott here. On average, how much do you think these interviews are worth to you? Of course, I've never charged for my archives in a dozen years of doing this, and I'm not about to start. But at patreon.com/ScottWhortonShow, you can name your own price to help support and make sure there's still new interviews to give away. So what do you think? 2 bits? A buck and a half? There are usually about 80 interviews per month, I guess, so take that into account. You can also cap the amount you'd be willing to spend in case things get out of hand around here. That's patreon.com/ScottWhortonShow. And thanks, y'all. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. All right, so, Now, first, I got to talk about Trump. I was actually called out on Twitter. Hey, man, how come you never talk about Trump? You hate Rand all day, but I don't see you spreading that hate around where it belongs. You know what? Fair enough, dude, because you don't know me that well. You don't know what, you know, this, that. I only talk about Rand all day because of how great he could be and just how disappointed I am. I don't sit around talking about John Kasich either. But then again, Trump is the front runner. And Trump is running as an outsider against the entire establishment, right? All these politicians have mishandled everything he says. So that's worth addressing. You're right. So here's the deal with him. He's a fascist. Jeff Tucker wrote a great article all about it. What he is, he's a Republican, but he's not a conservative. He's a radical. He doesn't believe in freedom. He believes in power. Everything that the conservatives think the government should do, which is a lot, he thinks the government should really do the hell out of that. And, you know, I don't know. I think, actually, the fact that he's a clown makes him seem less dangerous than he really is. He's entertaining enough on TV. He's got the name recognition. I mean, I don't know, man. I guess I figure he's such a freak show that he'll end up, he'll do something to blow himself up, you know, long before nomination day. He may just be here to, you know, job for Hillary, really. I think there's a, you know, pretty good possibility. I mean, the story of the Clinton phone call, the Bill Clinton phone call, did you read about that? Where Bill Clinton called and said, you know, you're making such an impression on people, Donald, right now. I think you're really doing great, man. And just, ha ha. Like that time that Emperor Palpatine tricked Jar Jar Binks into giving him the emergency powers. They said all sides denied that, that Bill told him, yeah, Donald, run. But he just said everything but that. I think that's kind of funny, dude. I hate Bill Clinton more than all of y'all combined, but I gotta laugh when he screws the Republicans right in the face like this. They just love it, man. They just love getting screwed in the face by Bill Clinton, don't they, American conservatives? Read it. It's in the Washington Post, dude. It's really something. And you can tell the story started with Trump's side, and then they went and got confirmation from Bill's side, and they didn't deny it. They're like, yeah, okay. Anyway, read the thing. But anyway, so to the point, Trump is bad on everything. He has no real policy or coherent thing. As Jeff Tucker says, the only thing consistent about him is his answer is, whatever it is, I'll solve it with my strength and power and wisdom. That's a problematic problem. You never hear him say ever, well, you know, I don't think there's a role for government in that. I think the market would handle it much better or whatever. Never that. Always a plan of one kind or the other. And so now go down the list. On war, he's an absolute nightmare. He opposed the Iraq war, sure. I don't know why. I guess because he was smart. He says it's because he was smart. And he just knew it was going to destabilize the whole damn region. Well, I'll give him credit for that. Guess what? About 170 million Americans knew better, too. So he was one of them. Okay. But then what has he had to say about the Middle East since then? Iraq, Iran, or anyone else? Kill them and take all their oil away. Starve them out. That's how you crush your enemy. Right, like he's Genghis Khan. Just go in there and we'll just starve them all to death. Wow. They asked him about ISIS, and he said, we'll go in there and we'll take all of Iran's oil away. And we'll blast them. Wow. Shouldn't have done that war, but now that we've done it, we should steal all their oil to make them pay for what we've done to them. Also, we should get confused and attack the country next door that we've been fighting for all this time, too. In fact, if you read Justin Raimondo's article today, he really highlights two or three different times in the debate the other night where all these different Republicans, Carly Fiorina and all a bunch of different ones, they all conflate ISIS and Iran. They all act as though ISIS is a front for Iran rather than their most dangerous enemy that they're fighting right now. When in fact, ISIS's ideology is that the only good Shiite is a dead Shiite. They are deadly enemies that can never compromise, ever, right? Iran will fight until ISIS is crushed because they have to. They're not going to tolerate ISIS on their western border. I mean, America moved their western border quite a few hundred miles to the west, but that's America's fault. But anyway, so he's horrible on race, horrible on immigration, obviously hates blacks and Mexicans. He said, oh, yeah, I like to see these Black Lives Matter women protesters try to interrupt me. I'll fight them. Can't you just see it, too? Him decking some lady with a sign, you know? Not yet, but soon enough. And then all of his stuff about immigration is just completely freaking ridiculous. And by the way, I'm glad I mentioned that because it gives me a great opportunity to talk about this article by Thomas Edlam. And Thomas Edlam is a Bircher. He's one of the, I guess he's the only Bircher I like anymore. Bill Jasper, screw you, idiot. Tom Edlam, though, I like him, man. And he wrote this for the Future of Freedom. Conservatives deceived me on immigration. If you're not familiar, the Birchers, that means the right wing. And they're not white supremacists, but they are very conservative. They're not really radicals. They're conservatives. But they're very, very freaking conservative. I mean, like, worship George Washington basically as a junior Jesus kind of deity. Very nationalistic, very patriotic. I think they're split Catholic and Protestant, but almost entirely Christian and probably almost entirely white as well, although not exclusively so. But so here's Thomas Edlam attacking the right from the right and saying all these myths about the wrongs and dangers and bads and costs of immigration are just not true. They're just not true. You can believe in them if you want, conservatives, with your emotions and your faith. But your facts are wrong. And here Thomas Edlam nails you. Conservatives deceive me on immigration. Anyway, so back to Trump. Horrible on trade, as Jeff Tucker emphasizes. He talks about trade as though America is this singular entity in direct competition with every other nation in the world, when that's not the way trade and free market economics work or even conceive, the starting point of the way the world works. It's a very dangerous... It's National Socialism. If Harry Brown was here, he would say, dude, this is called National Socialism. I know he would say that because I heard him say that about conservatives before. I know it's an appeal to authority, but it's also correct. Makes me sound a little bit less crazy because Harry Brown was pure awesome. And then, you know what? Bernie Sanders is the Trump of the other side. He's just as dangerous, economically speaking. And I don't think he's quite a psychopath and evil the way that Trump is, but he's just as dangerous. His economics are just as flawed. And they both represent the fear of the American people of our current economic circumstances. That's what they both really represent. Depressions are the health of the state. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Jacob Hornberger, tireless champion of liberty and president of the FFF, brings you the best libertarian writers every month on the topics that need our treatment the most. Read Jacob, Jim Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Joe Stromberg, and more every month in The Future of Freedom. It's just $25 a year for the pocket-sized print edition, $15 to read it online. The Future of Freedom, fff.org/subscribe. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Again, coming up, the great Robert Higgs, as well as Ray McGovern. And this will be a little bit redundant, actually, with what I'm going to ask Higgs about, too. But maybe if I talk about it here myself, it'll give me incentive to keep my questions shorter. I don't know. Probably not. Anyway, what I'm trying to say is, what I'm trying to talk about is the, sentiment, I guess, for people to, choose to rally around people like, Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. Sanders now leading Clinton in New Hampshire, which is right next door to Vermont. So he's got a leg up there. He'll never have enough money to really oppose her, I don't think. But it does go to show hatred for the center, the extreme center. There's nothing moderate about the center. They are the extremists. Okay, well, the right and the left are extremists, too, in certain ways. But the centrists, they ain't moderates. Whoever told you that was a synonym was a damn liar or college professor or both. But it's a good thing that people don't want Bush and Clinton. Oh, come on, Bush and Clinton. You don't have to be a political person. Just regular people are going, no, we don't want Bushes and Clintons. Isn't there anybody else? So they're excited to see people who seem like outsiders. Well, Sanders has been a senator for a long time, but he calls himself a socialist. And he's willing to say radical things about stealing money from rich people and giving it to you that most Democrats don't talk quite, you know, as starkly as all that. And he just seems like an outsider. He's got that outsider persona. And that's why people are rallying around Trump. And people don't know about economics. People don't know if what Bernie Sanders is saying or what Donald Trump is saying, which is a lot of the same stuff as far as protectionism and that kind of thing. They don't know whether it's good economics or not. But they know that, well, Trump is saying that that's what he cares about. I'm going to give you your damn job back. Remember back when your town had a factory and you guys, you know, liked your lives? Well, that's going to happen again once you elect Donald Trump. Because I'm the president. I'm going to make it that way. I'm going to make Ford bring the factory back from Mexico. That was another Jeff Tucker example. Why are they going to come back from Mexico? Because I'll be the president and just trust me, they're coming back all right. Okay. But anyway, that's what people want to hear. And why do they want to hear that? Because their factory moved to Mexico. Because their town sucks. Because they're not living a good life. Because they're still in the midst of the Great Recession. And so they're dislocated. And the appeal of the demagogue, making big promises from atop his white horse, you know, that's what desperate people want to hear. And who's telling them different? You know, if Ron Paul was here, he would be saying, don't worry, everyone. All we need is freedom. Really? No, really, not an ideological thing. Check it out. Here's how it works. And then he explains. And yeah, I mean, this includes, we need sound money. That's a huge part of it. It's this government, central bank generated boom and bust cycle that keeps dislocating our economy, building up massive bubbles that necessitate massive corrections that destabilize our whole society. And of course, the lower on the economic ladder you are, the worse you get it. The more marginal your business, you know, or even the newer your business is, whether it's actually a good idea, all things being equal or not, the sooner you're taken out. And every time this happens, people go, I can't understand, where'd all the money go? How come everybody was all buying stuff and trading, and then all of a sudden everybody just stayed home and quit spending money? People can't see it. They don't understand it. And they don't have Ron Paul to tell them anymore about what's happening to them. And so they're looking for someone to tell them that I'm going to solve it for you. When the answer, of course, has to be, I'm going to make the government allow you to solve this for yourself. And because socialism doesn't work, that's why. Because the reason why we have all this stuff, and I'm thinking first and foremost the groceries, is because of the magic of capital. See, what happens with money is when you save it up, then you can invest it on projects that make things better for people. This is the danger of Bernie Sanders. He's like the inverse kind of mirror image or some kind of weird thing of Donald Trump. An economic protectionist and interventionist and demagogue along the same kind of lines. But what does he want to do? And he'll even tell you, you're supposed to love it. What we're going to do, we're going to take all the capital and we're just going to give it to you. And then you won't need a job because you'll be on welfare. So it'll be great. I mean, you'll be fired. But don't worry about it. I mean, this is the... And people are buying this, man. Because people don't understand it. They don't know. Well, look, he said he just wants to pick on rich people. As far as Americans know, rich people spend all of their money on their lifestyle. On their yacht and their car. But, of course, that's not what they do. They invest that money, and that investment, that money goes to buy new and improved machine tools for use in the factory to make the things that you use. A perfect example of Bernie Sanders' demagoguery and just ignorance. I swear to God, he sounds like a sixth grade, you know, social studies teacher or something. He says, well, there's just way too much variety in consumer choices. You have, and then this is his example. I'm sure he's made even worse examples before. But the same thing could apply if he was talking about cars or houses or anything else. He says, you look on the shelf at the grocery store and you see just how many different kinds of deodorant there are. And we got people going hungry. And yet we're spending all this money just to have a shelf full of all these different kinds of deodorant. Now, I guess on a very superficial level, like, that sounds smart and appealing, especially to liberals, I guess. That, like, yeah, couldn't we all just agree on one basic kind of deodorant and spend that extra money helping people or something? Because they just don't understand that that's what people do for a living, is they work at the deodorant factory. Or they work driving a truck delivering deodorant to people who need to put the deodorant on the smell that they like. That they have to wear on their body to work and around their world all day. And they have to be around other people who have to, you know, find that pleasant too, or pleasant enough, tolerable enough, right? And so, this is what wealth means, right? This is how people are getting paid. They're trading and distributing deodorant and cars and houses and machine tools and things that machine tools make. And you know what I mean? Where do you think these bulldozers come from, man? Somebody could have spent all that money on coke and whores. Whores! But instead, they invested it in making bulldozers that could be sold for other people to buy with the money that they saved so that they could use it to construct a thing for people to use. That's what wealth is, Bernie Sanders. Varieties of deodorant, dude. Value isn't determined by commie senators from Vermont. Value is determined by the consumer. And, you know, this is the kind of thinking that can really drive America right into a freaking ditch. Right into a ditch. Both of these guys, Trump and Sanders both. They're both demagogues. Trump against the weak, Sanders against the strong, but still both of them are basically strapping a suicide bomb to the American people, to our country, if we let them get away with it. What we need to do is remember what Ron Paul said. All we need is liberty. And check it out, Bob Higgs is going to talk about that here in a few too.
Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Oh, I better hit pause on that, man. Yeah, it's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Libertarian foreign policy, mostly. We'll be talking economics with Bob Higgs coming up here in just a few. And we'll be talking Ukraine again with Ray McGovern. I know, man, I haven't been doing near a good enough job covering Ukraine on the show lately, guys. I'm sorry about that. And try to get it together for you here. But yeah, let's talk about the Iran deal for a minute. There's a guy named Gary Samore who used to work for Obama, and then he left the administration to go work for United Against Nuclear Iran, bankrolled by Likud faction bankroller Sheldon Adelson, the casino tycoon. And he's now left United Against Nuclear Iran to support the deal. Can you believe that? I ain't making that up, man. That's a thing that happened. And then they replaced him with Joe Lieberman. Bah! Joe Lieberman. Man, we should do a focus group or something, but I'm pretty sure everybody hates Joe Lieberman, right? I think that's probably a good thing they brought him back for this. But the fact that Gary Samore is supporting the deal, I think, is a really big deal. You know, right? It's a huge defection from the war party is what it is. Another thing I wanted to point out about the Iran deal is a guy named James Acton. Well, first of all, Yosef Butt, our friend Yosef Butt had a piece for Reuters, which I lost. Where is it? Okay, I lost the damn Yosef Butt article. But anyway, Yosef Butt wrote a whole thing about it for, I forget if it was Reuters or The Hill. Might have been for The Hill. Anyway, but then there's this guy, James Acton. On Twitter, he's James_Acton32. Senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. That's funny. Nuclear nerd. And anyway, so he got in a fight with David, the other ISIS, Albright, who is an Israeli propagandist, basically puts forward a bunch of crap and red herrings and straw man arguments all the time to try to make it seem like Iran is cheating on this or that aspect of the deal. His batting average is about the same as the MEK at this point, I think. But so James Acton got into it with him yesterday on Twitter, and it was about ISIS telling the newspaper, and of course they don't check this stuff themselves. They go, well, David Albright is an expert. I heard somewhere. I mean, he's not a physicist and never really was a IAEA employee or anything, and self-described expert, maybe. They don't check. But David Albright says that, oh, there's a difference in pictures at Parchin from 2011, between 2011 and right now. And James Acton is challenging him and saying, yeah, but so how does that even imply that there's anything currently happening there? How does it even imply that, much less prove it? It doesn't. Sorry. And we're supposed to believe what? That if the Iranians pave over a former warehouse and make a parking lot there, that they're going to be able to hide traces of uranium? Or for that matter, of whatever other heavy metal. I mean, if they're testing implosion systems, they'd really need depleted uranium or, you know, possibly lead. But even then, you think that the IAEA can't find that? The IAEA has already been to Parchin over and over again. This is a ridiculous red herring. But, you know, like I remember in the days of driving a cab and listening to the top of the hour radio news. I mean, we've got Daryl Perry for our show, which is a miracle, right? This is Daryl Perry's the best top of the hour radio news in the history of all radio news, period. Hands down by a million miles. But if you drive around, you know, if you drive a truck for a living or a cab or whatever, and you're out driving around or you got a long commute, you listen to talk radio, top of the hour news, you've heard 10 million stories about Iran and their nuclear program. Oh my God, new satellite evidence indicates that the Iranians have been cheating at their secret base where we haven't, and they won't allow the inspections. And then they go on to the next story, and you're going, my God, those damned Iranians. And you've heard that kind of thing a million times. Iranian dissident group exposes secret tunnels with nuclear work going on outside Tehran. They never run the correction. Oh, it turned out that was a bunch of crap. Don't be stupid. And so you hear a million of them, and it doesn't matter if zero times a million is still zero. Sounds like it must add up to something. Well, where there's smoke, there's fire. Yeah, but that's steam. That's hot air, not smoke. Look closer. Listen closer. The same people used to constantly refer to Iran's illicit nuclear weapons program, like David Sanger at the New York Times, they now call it Iran's civilian nuclear program. Huh. And funny how they never had to run a thing where they go, oh yeah, by the way, I was wrong and or lying that whole time I was calling it Iran's illicit nuclear weapons program. Turned out that didn't exist. Sorry, I have no credibility whatsoever. I'm David Sanger and I'm going to go jump off the top of the New York Times building now. Nope. They never run one like that, do they? Oh, here's one debunking ISIS here. Jonathan Tyrone at Bloomberg Business. Concern about Iran's Parchin facility not supported by the images. And it's almost like a religious thing. Yeah, exactly. But we have faith that if only we come up with enough bogus red herrings about Iran's nuclear program, we can make it seem like something scary. I mean, what are you going to do? Learn the math on this nuclear stuff? Forget it. Just defer to the people who are telling you that this is too dangerous to worry about math problems. This is too dangerous to wait around. We can't let the smoking gun be a mushroom cloud. In other words, they have no evidence at all. We can't risk waiting around for evidence to exist. Okay, I guess you got me and my mom and dad sufficiently terrified. Go ahead. It's like last time, whatever you guys say, man. When do we start bombing them? The one I really like is where Americans, by the tens of millions or more, think that Iran has nuclear weapons and want a war with them. Really? You think they already got nukes? But you want to get in a war with them? They could kill you with their nukes if they had nukes, assuming, you know, they could deliver them somehow. But I mean, I guess if you believe they got nukes, then you probably assume they can deliver them too. I don't know. The pollster calls and people's top priority is, what do I think the pollster wants me to say? Because I don't know. Hey, can you tell me what are the majority of people answered so far? I'll just say the same thing as them. Anyway, and you know, I don't know. This is, it's pseudo sort of kind of an appeal to authority, but not really. I don't think that's really a logical fallacy. It's, you know, it's an open letter from 36 retired generals and admirals. I think it's safe to assume they are not all Democrats. 36 American generals and admirals have written an open letter saying the Iran deal benefits U.S. national security. Now, I'm not saying that's true because they say so. I'm saying that's true anyway, and you've heard me make the case for negotiating with Iran for a decade straight now. So I'm not appealing to their authority for that. But what I am appealing to their authority for, in a sense, is to show and to cover the right flank of this argument. That this is not some panty waist, liberal, Democrat, homosexual, Islamic, you know, traitorous, sellout of Israel, blah, 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 like you always hear. Some terrible, un-American deal. Oh, putting the whole world at such great risk and all this crap. And what the Israelis and their fifth column in America are attempting to do is create a dominant narrative that this is just crazy. It's almost inexplicable that the president of the United States of America would basically act as an agent of the Islamic extremist terrorist crazy enemies of America. Isn't that insane? Yeah, well, it's because it's not true. That's not what's going on here at all. That's the argument they're trying to win, and I think that this letter disproves that when you look at the numbers of generals and admirals who support the president on this deal. And hell, read it yourself. Read Gareth Porter's Manufactured Crisis.
Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org.
Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. First guest up today is the great Robert Higgs. Welcome back to the show, Bob. How are you?
I'm fine, Scott.
It's been way too long since we talked. Way too long. Let me ask you, I wasn't sure what to say. Are you now officially retired from the Independent Institute?
I am not retired from the Institute.
Okay.
But I'm working my way into retirement.
All right, good deal. I heard that you were moving.
That's right. We hope to actually make our move in October, but we've been involved in getting ready to move for years, actually.
Right. All right. Good deal. All right. So, yeah, there you go. Robert Higgs, check out his page on Amazon. He's written a lot of very important books. I guess most importantly, not sell anything else short, but especially for this show's purposes, Crisis and Leviathan. Critical episodes in the growth of American government. Also, Against Leviathan, the transformation of the American economy, 1865 through 1914, Depression War and Cold War, which is another extremely important book that I hope everyone will get themselves very familiar with. I'm so thrilled to have you back on the show, Bob. And there's a lot of different things I want to ask you about. But, there's one more thing I have to say about you before I start asking you things. And that is that, was it just this last weekend, you gave this incredible speech, War and the Growth of Government, at Mises, where Lou awarded you the Rothbard Medal. And that was really something to see in a great speech that you gave there. War is the master key of the state, you said. That was just this last weekend, right?
I believe that was on the 20th of July.
I'm sorry. It was a few weeks back. Anyway, so there you go. War and the Growth of Government. It's at Mises Media on YouTube. Great speech that you gave there. The master key. I like that. War is the health of the state. The master key of the state, even. Turn it up a notch from the great Randolph Bourne there. All right. And you know what? I think we'll get back to that. But the thing I really want to ask you about is about prices in the 1920s. And I know that sounds boring, but really, you've explained before about how in the roaring 20s, prices were increasing some, I think, but they would have been increasing. No, I'm going to screw it all up. I'm sorry. I knew what the hell I meant in the first place, but I can't seem to say it right. The question is this. They say that there's, you know, not much price inflation now, but we know that there's been a lot of monetary inflation. And so the question is, how much lower do you think prices would be if they had let them collapse? That's what I'm trying to get to. And I've heard you explain the same kind of phenomenon in the 20s. And I just wonder if you could tell us where you think we are in the boom and bust cycle, if it's a big deflationary hole that's filled with phony money. Is that just as bad as having an artificial bubble full of phony money?
Well, Scott, in the 1920s, what happened was after the fall of prices, which was quite substantial in 1920 and 21, the overall price level pretty much stayed the same. It hardly changed at all from 1922 through 1929. And, you know, for monetarists such as Milton Friedman, that signified a great success by the Federal Reserve System. Look, they've achieved stable prices. That's what all civilized people supposedly want. But what should have happened instead was that the Fed should have been less activist in trying to help the British get back on the pound sterling exchange with gold. And if they had done so, then prices would have fallen even further, because they never did fall back to anything close to the pre-war levels in the United States. And so what was happening was that Fed policy in the 20s was, in fact, creating easy credit conditions, particularly in certain years. And the result was to bring about malinvestments on a very large scale, particularly in real estate developments, offices, other forms of long-lived capital. And that built up a lot of structural imbalances in the economy and resulted in the eventual beginning of a recession in 1929. So that was the story of the price level at that time. But the story this time is overwhelmingly that, yes, as you say, the Fed has engineered a tremendous increase in the monetary base, particularly the volume of commercial bank deposits in Federal Reserve banks. But the money supply itself, the actual medium of exchange that people use in buying and selling goods and services, has grown only fairly modestly. It has grown, but it hasn't grown even in the same order of magnitude or several orders of magnitude as the monetary base. And what this tells us is that the two things. On the one hand, commercial banks have not wanted to lend money they could have lent, and there are a number of reasons for that, including their own apprehensions about their balance sheets after 2008. And the other is that the public has not wanted to borrow money from commercial banks, and part of the reason for that is that so there was a big increase in the demand for cash to hold from 2008 onwards, and so we've been in this extraordinary situation. It's never happened before. It's not anything like what happened in the 1920s, but there exists this gigantic potential for the money stock to increase enormously and thereby to trigger real hyperinflation. But that potential has not been realized at all. Basically, prices have, in general, not all prices, but the price indexes for final goods and services have signified very low inflation since the recession, but some asset prices have run up considerably.
Okay. Now, so I'm sorry I botched that question so badly about trying to paraphrase you on the 20s and getting it so poor. But yeah, so the 20s deal, as you're saying, the prices would have been falling, but the Fed was propping them up where they were staying relatively the same. And really, so that was malinvestment there. And then, as you've explained before too, it was really toward the end of the '20s, I guess 27 was when they really started generating a big bubble, in order to try to prop up the pound and all that. So that's what I was trying. That was the analogy I was trying to make. And then, so what I'm learning is you're shooting that down, that we're not in a situation now where prices have been relatively stable, but they would be much lower except for the fact that government has been filling that hole up with the money. And you're saying that the difference is because the Fed has figured out this trick where they can pay the bank, they can create all this money out of nothing to bail out the banks and keep them whole no matter what, but pay them to keep the money all at the Fed rather than loaning it out?
Well, they do pay interest. They started doing that in the fall of 2008. But the interest rate they pay on deposits at the Fed is so negligible, Scott, that I think it's a mistake for people to make much of it. They've only been paying for years now 0.25%. Now, because prices have increased somewhat, if only 2 or 3% a year, paying an interest rate of 0.25% is paying a real interest rate that's negative. In other words, the deposits that commercial banks are holding in the Federal Reserve banks are losing value in real terms year after year, even though the Fed is paying this little interest rate to them for holding those deposits.
Mm-hmm.
So the explanation for why they're holding such a gigantic volume of deposits cannot really be because the Fed is paying interest
right
on them. There has to be
okay
something much more important going on.
All right, that's a great place to hold it. We'll be right back with the great Robert Higgs right after this, y'all.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America Lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel Lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm no economist, but I like the Austrian ones. I got Bob Higgs on the line. We're talking about money and monetary policy and what it all means. And I'm basically a blind man poking around with a stick here trying to even ask right questions. But, you know, he's being very patient. It's nice. So now, okay, where we left off, Bob, you're explaining how, no, it's not as the conventional wisdom goes, the Fed scheme to pay interest to the banks to keep their money at the Fed, that's keeping them from lending it out, and as you said previously, that's keeping people from wanting to borrow it. But, so what is it then, especially the borrowers? It seems like things are certainly looking better than they were in 2009, and the interest rates are so low. Isn't it a perfect time for people to be generating a giant bubble by borrowing a bunch of money?
Well, a couple of things have been happening, Scott. On the one hand, the large corporations that do a lot of the borrowing from commercial banks have had plenty of liquidity of their own. For years now, they've had large cash balances on their hands, and if they wanted to undertake new investments, launch into new lines of business or whatever that required a large expenditure, they could finance that out of internal sources in most cases. So they're just not in the market to borrow when they already have money in the bank sitting there in their own short-term securities earning practically nothing, because interest rates in short-term securities are 1% or less and have been for years. So on the one hand, you've got the big companies that don't need to borrow from the banks. On the other hand, you've got the smaller companies, startups and so forth, that are high-risk borrowers. And the banks are reluctant to lend to that kind of borrower, and have been reluctant ever since the financial debacle of 2008, because so many of the banks themselves have shaky balance sheets. Correct accounting had been employed back in 2008 and 2009, the accounts would have shown that many of the big banks were in fact bankrupt. But because the assets they held, people's notes to repay loans, were not being revalued downward as they should have been, these banks looked as if they were solvent, but really weren't. But they knew their situation, and because they knew it, they have been trying ever since to avoid risky loans and to rebuild their balance sheets, and also to meet new capital requirements that have been put on them through the Basel system. And so, the banks certainly made it harder for people, say, to refinance mortgages. I experienced that myself 2 or 3 years ago when I refinanced mine. Never had to submit so much paperwork, so much documentation before, and even though I'm like a prime borrower, if I say so myself, they still weren't so eager to hand the money over to me without a lot of documentation, and certainly they've been applying those kinds of more stringent standards to borrowers in general. So that puts small firms and startup companies at a disadvantage, and they just get turned down when they go to the big banks for money.
Mm. So then, where does that put us on the business cycle? Then we're still, I guess, we're past the crash and deflation stage, but it doesn't sound like we're very far along in creating the next big bubbles before they pop. But then again, I saw Alan Greenspan, the guy who did this to us last time on. I think Bloomberg, something on the internet the other day, saying that he's afraid that there's a giant bond bubble now. What does that mean?
Well, what's happened is that since about the middle of 2009 or the latter part of 2009, there's been a feeble recovery in general. Now, some sectors have hardly recovered at all. For example, real estate construction, after its huge decline during the recession has scarcely increased the volume of building at all. So it's just been stuck at this low level for years and years. However, the banks have had money to lend to certain people, and some people have had their own sources of funds. And the result has been, with interest rates so low, as I was mentioning, short-term, secure-type notes are only paying 1% or less. If you go to the bank and get a CD, that won't even pay you 1%, which is a negative real rate of interest. Now, this situation with the Fed holding interest rates, particularly at the short-term end, so low for so long, has put people in a position where the only way to get a substantial real return on investment has been to put their money into riskier investments such as commodities, third world economies, kind of oddball type investments that that, you know, the big investors know about and involve themselves in, but we ordinary people know nothing about and don't have access to, basically, except through middlemen who accept our money and then invest it on our behalf. But the upshot has been, as I mentioned before, that even though general inflation, in the usual sense that people measure it these days, has been quite low, there's been quite a lot of asset price inflation in some markets. The real estate has run up again in almost every part of the country from the crash lows in 2009. So real estate's run up. Commodities ran up a lot. Depend on the particular commodity, of course, how much it's run up. Bonds ran up, and that's what Greenspan's referring to there. That's just another way of saying interest rates have been kept low. Say, you know, bond prices and interest rates move inversely by definition. So you've got all these asset markets that have had substantial price increases. Now, whether they've had bubbles or not is usually the sort of thing that we only can identify ex post. You know, when a bubble bursts, we can all kind of rush in and say, well, yeah, that was a bubble. We should have known. But bubbles are really much harder to identify ex ante. And so it may well be that there are some genuine bubbles in some of the asset markets right now. And if so, it's inevitable that sooner or later that they will burst and there'll be huge price decreases in these assets. But it's very hard to say right now. It's keeping the speculators busy, and it's their business to make good guesses. They have their own money in the game, and so they're probably making their best guesses, even though no one knows the future, even the greatest speculator on earth.
Mm-hmm. Well, so just from the position I'm in, which is not an educated one on this, but just looking at the economy out of my own eyes and experience, it seems like the exact same thing as the 1990s and the 2000s again, where TV says prosperity, and that's because, yeah, well, they're doing good because they've got stock market investments and that kind of thing. As far as they know, it's good. But for everybody at, you know, say, at least the bottom half or whatever, nothing's hardly moved or changed at all. It's still the Great Recession to us. And then so that means the crash is coming soon again, I guess.
Well, I think actually the 90s were a more prosperous period across the board than the situation has been since 2008. There has been some recovery in labor markets, but particularly the volume of private employment has been stuck at a very low level, 4 or 5 million jobs fewer than before the recession. So that's been a real trouble sign there of just how poorly the economy has been performing. A lot of people have dropped out of looking for work, or they found ways of getting income, like going on disability benefits or some other kind of government handout that has allowed them to get by. But this is certainly, you know, to call the period since 2009 prosperity would be wrong. It's been a period of limited recovery. I don't think it's completely false recovery, but it's so little that many people, of course, have not noticed it because it hasn't really affected everybody. Even when the average has gone up a little bit for people's real incomes, lots of people haven't participated in that increase. So yes, it might look as if the recession's never ended to a lot of people, even though for the more fortunate ones, things have not been so dire.
Yep. All right, I'm sorry. I got a million more things to ask you, but we're just all out of time. I hope we could do this again soon, though.
Well, it's always good to talk to you, Scott.
Very good to have you back on the show, Bob. Appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.
All right, y'all. That's the great Robert Higgs. He's at the Independent Institute, independent.org. He's also the author of Crisis and Leviathan, Against Leviathan, Depression, War, and Cold War, Neither Liberty Nor Safety, Delusions of Power, Resurgence of the Warfare State, Opposing the Crusader State. That's not all. More. Arms, politics, and the economy, and more and more and more. Check him out on Amazon.com. We'll be right back in just a sec with Ray McGovern. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, y'all, Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all. And they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from MasterSamuraiTech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at MasterSamuraiTech.com. All right, y'all, we went into the break there with the previous guest, but you'll be able to hear that whole thing in the archives there. Bob Higgs. It'll be up there tomorrow morning, probably. ScottHorton.org. And this one will be, too. Ray McGovern. From Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity and ConsortiumNews.com and RayMcGovern.com. Welcome back to the show. Ray, how are you?
Thanks, Scott. Doing well.
I'm very happy to have you back on the show. And, I should tell people that back when you were a CIA officer, I should mention that he's a former CIA officer. That's why the Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity thing there. And back when he was a CIA officer, expert and boss of experts on the Soviet Union back in the days of the Cold War, real expert on Russia, Ukraine, and America's interests and interventions in Eastern Europe and the rest of it. And that's why I got you here. I want you to tell me everything you know about what is going on recently, and that is important between America and Ukraine and Russia. And I guess give me the bad news first, please.
Well, the bad news looks like the forces that would like to see Minsk II dead seem to be prevailing this week.
Now, that's the supposedly prevailing peace treaty that we have right now.
Yeah, the arrangement there dated February 12th, where Poroshenko was faced down by Putin and some of the allies and agreed to pull heavy armor, heavy artillery, and tanks away from a disengagement zone there next to the Donbass, and also to start negotiating a regional settlement, some kind of regional autonomy for the folks there in Donetsk and Luhansk. Now, that has been faltering all along. One of the interesting things here is that the right sector, proto-fascists, have been dead set against Poroshenko dealing with Russia or even abiding by Minsk II. And he's been trying, it seems, but it seems that they're very strong. And this is my best guess as to why he doesn't feel capable. You have the right sector and then the wrong sector. The wrong sector, I would say, is Assistant Secretary of State Victoria Nuland. She's got it wrong about Ukraine. What she doesn't understand is that everything that her puppets there, including the right sector, try, will be matched in force by Russia. This is Russia's neighborhood. I don't really understand how someone like Victoria Nuland, arrogant as she is, can't see that Russia holds the upper hand in that part of the world.
Man. And, you know, this right sector thing, it's sort of like the Al-Shabaab, where they're the smallest, weakest part of the Islamic Courts Union until Bush smashed it and turned them into the only, you know, worthy fighting force. They're the youth. That's what Shabaab means, the youth. The young guys who are angry enough and have rifles enough to do something about it, who then grew up and became a much more powerful force in opposing and throwing out the Ethiopians. Same kind of thing, where right sector was come on, a street gang, basically, with a little kind of Sinn Féin political unit. But they're basically a bunch of toughs and thugs, but, you know, street toughs, not battlefield tested, you know, and trained by American special forces and all kinds of things. I mean, we're really creating a Nazi army over there, Ray. Tell me I'm overreacting.
Well, we are training whomever we're training.
Well, they say they're training the National Guard, but who's the National Guard? It's the right sector.
Yeah, you know, John Conyers, to his credit, tried to introduce legislation saying that we shall not arm and train the Azov Brigade. Now, Azov Brigade is openly right sector, proto-fascist, the swastikas, even a spear, get this, Confederate flag every now and then seen in their, where they meet. So these are bad apples. And, you know, when the coup took place, the most blatant coup in human history, according to George Friedman of Stratfor, on the 22nd of February 2013, the right sector folks, having been trained by some special units in Poland and elsewhere, the National Endowment for Democracy and so forth put $5 billion into Ukraine over the previous years. So, yeah, they're a ragtag group of thugs, but they're organized now. And they and other similar thinking folks led the putsch, led the coup d'etat in February 22nd of 2013. And now they're sort of the spear point out there in the eastern Ukraine. You know, and they're kind of ideologues. They're sort of like Nuland herself. And how they think, you know, how they think that they can move their lines forward and kill a whole bunch of people in Donetsk and Luhansk without the Russians retaliating. Well, you know, maybe that's what they want. Maybe their aim is to get Russia in a bigger way, thereby able to blacken Putin still more and turn it into a wider conflict. You know, you and I don't think that's a good idea, but sometimes this mirror imaging can get us into trouble. Maybe that's what they want.
Yeah, well, and you know, it's been quite a while, and as you mentioned before, I guess there's been a few different statements along these lines and even, you know, protests and whatever waged where the right sector have basically said, you know, hey, Parliament, you don't rule us. I guess one of their leaders is a member of Parliament. But, you know, as you've said, they've said many times they're not bound by Minsk. And in fact, one of their leaders was quoted, and not by the Russian press either. I forget who it was now, but it wasn't. I think it was the Brits, saying that, well, what are you going to do about it? We overthrew the last government. You think we can't overthrow you? And so, you know, they've kind of created this SA here. And are they going to have the army crush it, or are they going to let it run wild, or what are they going to do? You know, it's threatening the parliament itself now.
Well, that's right. The folks in parliament, you know, they kind of take their orders from Victoria Nuland and Poroshenko, but not the right sector folks. And as you point out, there are right sector and other fascist type folks in that parliament. So, you know, it's a real, it's summer, of course. This is when military offenses take place. But I'm at a loss to think that Poroshenko is doing this of his own accord. I rather think that he's being forced into it by the right sector folks who, you know, are, you know, as a bunch of thugs that they are, they've been trained pretty well now, and they're probably a bit more of a match for the Ukrainian ordinary soldiers than anyone else. And I don't think Poroshenko really has control of the situation now, and that's perhaps why Putin and the Russians are not threatening right away, but they're expressing extreme concern. And it's not Putin's practice to threaten. He'll just do it, you know, and then the flag will go up, and Dr. Strangelove, I mean, Breedlove there, or General Breedlove there at NATO will say, aha, see, yeah, the Russians are invading Ukraine again.
You know, I just read a thing in the Washington Post, and actually someone sent along the link because it had a trial balloon about, well, maybe they need to go ahead and cut their losses about Donetsk and Luhansk in there. It was just a little bit. It was a very hawkish article that had a little bit of a kind of teaser like that in there. But at the same time, they said, well, according to NATO, there are, well, I forgot, 5,000 or 6,000 Russian troops inside eastern Ukraine right now. Oh, come on. They've said that 15 times since the coup. Since, you know, starting, I guess, after the seizure of Crimea, so, you know, a month after the coup or whatever. They've claimed that over and over and over again, a dozen times or more, that the Russians have invaded with thousands of infantry. They never provided the slightest proof of that. But that's, you know, the conventional narrative now is, I guess, that the eastern portions of Ukraine are already occupied by Russia, that, and the Russians, I guess, mean to go ahead and take them. I think your interpretation that if that happens, we could see what it's a reaction to right now. But oh, hang on one sec, Ray. We'll be right back. Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, y'all. Welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Ray McGovern, former CIA officer turned peacenik, and working on the Ukraine problem here. Boy, we're in real trouble here. Ray, they're talking about expanding the training to Ukraine's entire army. They already have thousands of trainers there, right? And not just Americans, but Australians and Brits, and I forget who else. Yeah, it doesn't sound like much of a stretch to think Americans could get killed in this thing, and then what might happen? And by the way, you also have Americans of stature saying, well, we need to be sending Russians home in body bags. I wonder if you think that they're completely crazy. Is there something in the water in Washington, D.C., or just what in the world is going on here? I mean, this is, you know, Americans, even on this show, I hardly pay any attention to this story when it's obviously the most important thing that ever happened since the Cuban Missile Crisis or something. What in the hell?
Well, you got that right, Scott. You got that right. And I think that, you know, that somebody did put something in the water here inside the Beltway about 12 years ago. It's, you know, how else do you explain this craziness? I'll tell you some insights that I've gotten from kind of putting some papers back in filing. I was reviewing a YouTube video of General Wesley Clark when he was running for president, October 2007.
Have the clip here if you want me to play it.
Well, I think it's not necessary. I just want to stick out one little clip here where he says, you know, I talked to Paul Wolfowitz after the successful attack on Iraq, Desert Storm, January, February of 1991. And he said that the biggest lesson that was learned there is that we can do what we want and post-Soviet Russia, quote, won't stop us, end quote.
Oh, okay. See, I don't have that clip. That'd be a good one.
Now, that's October 2007, okay? So that's the lesson they thought they'd learned. Now, when the U.S. attacked Iraq on false pretenses, you know, I never thought I'd feel any nostalgia for the Soviet Union. But I knew full well from my 50 years now of studying Russian history and Soviet history that we probably wouldn't have felt we could do that if there were a Soviet Union around and if the Soviet Union or Russia reacted more sharply to what we did in 1991 against Iraq. So that's the geopolitical situation that exists now. Now, General Clark has come up in other connections, and I have in front of me here a draft non-paper from the hand of George Soros, I should say, from the computer of one of his secretaries. And here's chapter one here, paragraph one. General Wesley Clark, Polish General Shapoka, and a few specialists under the auspices of the Atlantic Council will advise President Poroshenko how to restore the fighting capacity of Ukraine without violating the Minsk agreement. Right. Okay. So here he is, Clark, showing up there, training these folks. Now, I don't want to be too caustic here, but we really trained up those Iraqi troops real swell, didn't we? I mean, Petraeus saying, wow, you know, 300,000 crack troops now we have. And what happened a year ago? A year ago, June? They ran away when ISIL started firing a couple of AK-47s at them, and they left all their U.S.-given equipment behind. That's why ISIL is such a force as it is now. Okay?
In other words, the Ukrainian Nazis, they're mean enough that they can, you know, pick on the Ukrainian people, and they're mean enough that they can pick a fight with the Russians. But they can't stand against the Russians. Come on.
They can, but you got Clark, and you got others saying, yeah, we can train these guys. And then we could go back to MSNBC and CNN and the others and say, these trainings are going great. And then you'll see who profits from this. Now, tension is good for business. War, even better. And the people in control of our government and foreign policy have no keine Ahnung, as the Germans would say. They don't have any concept of what war is like, because they never served, most of them. And they, you know, think they can ratchet up this stuff into a situation where the Soviets or the Russians will come in. And then they'll, as you say, one of these trainers is going to get killed. And then, mainstream media is going to have a free for all. Not only that, but you probably remember, since we're mentioning Wesley Clark, and he said, you know, we ought to start rounding up Americans who are dissenting against our, they should be looked on as subversives.
Yeah.
This is about 2 weeks ago. So we have not only fascism being supported in Ukraine, but incipient fascism being supported by the likes of four-star general, former NATO commander, General Wesley Clark.
Yeah, former Democratic presidential candidate.
And you know what Americans don't realize is that we started it, okay? It's clear as day. You know, everybody's entitled to their own opinion. Not everybody's entitled to their own facts. I had an example of how abysmal the ignorance is on this subject when I was attending a little seminar with very progressive people. And a professor here from one of the universities in Washington said, you know, my son came home from Sunday school with a nice little placard that he made, and it said, Putin, haven't you heard thou shalt not kill? And she smiled, and everybody else smiled. And I said, you know, skunk at the picnic that I am, Scott, I raised my hand, I said, well, what's the illusion there? And she said, Crimea, of course, Crimea. I said, well, how many people were killed in Crimea? Oh, hundreds, probably thousands. I said, would you believe none? Would you believe zero? Oh, no, I can't believe that. Well, of course they can't believe that, because they never hear that in the mainstream media. So what we have here is a situation where the media is really, really abysmal. Now, I had one very unusual chance to point that out to the Washington Post, which is the worst on this, worst bar none, although close second to the New York Times. What happened was Joe Lieberman wrote an article three Sundays ago, okay, and he said Putin attacked Ukraine without provocation. And so I wrote this little thing, and I was shocked that it got in. I said, you know, the Post article starts with Putin had an early plan to annex Crimea. This was an article back in March before McCain. Now, that article described, quote, a secret meeting Mr. Putin held on February 23, 2014, during which, quote, Russia decided it would take the Crimea Peninsula, end quote. So that's the report in the Post, okay? Now, I pointed out that there was no mention of what happened the previous day. And most of your listeners will know this, but they are in a minority. What happened the previous day is what George Friedman called the most blatant coup in the history of mankind, okay? So the fact that Putin got his national security advisors together on the 23rd and planned what they should do about Crimea is no surprise. We would have done exactly the same thing. And to their credit, I suppose I'd have to give them credit for printing my article, because it directly criticizes what the Post had put in there before. But the whole thrust here of what I'm trying to say is that what we have is a reaction on the part of Russia to what they warned us would be niet. Okay, niet. When rumors started circulating in January of 2008, okay, what's that, 7 years ago, that Ukraine and Georgia would be folded into NATO, the Russians went crazy. And Lavrov, who was foreign minister then as well as now, called Bill Burns, our ambassador to Moscow, and he said, look, he says, you know what niet means? Niet means niet. If you even think about putting Ukraine in NATO, we will be obliged to consider out what we're going to do, and there would likely be a civil war in Ukraine. So niet means niet, okay? That was February 1, 2008. April 2, NATO decides in its wisdom, Ukraine and Georgia will become members of NATO. That's a direct quote. Now, how do I know that our ambassador in Moscow was warned so specifically? Well, I know it because Chelsea Manning, formerly Bradley Manning, leaked a whole bunch of State Department cables. If I've read one from Moscow, I've read about 1,000, okay? Mm-hmm. And this one was titled, to his credit, by Ambassador Burns, Niet means Niet, Moscow's red line on Ukraine.
Wow. Okay? Now, very that's, good. That's you, the first I've heard of that one, too.
You can download
and it. It was right around this time that Vladimir Putin himself said, hey, look, my soldiers could walk to Kiev in 2 weeks. Does anyone doubt that?
That was a little later, yeah.
Oh, a little later. That's pretty explicit language. That's sort of like saying, you know what? You could try to overthrow the government in, Toronto? Who the hell rules the Canadians? You could try to overthrow them, but we won't let you. You could try to bring them into your military alliance, but we will invade and occupy the place. Want to make a bet? Doesn't that sound like what American policy would be if anybody was messing with the Canadians' independence from our empire?
Yeah, but you see, we have a Monroe Doctrine that allows us to do that. Now, Russia, they don't... I'm being facetious.
Oh, they never had a President Monroe. Well, that's their problem then. It's a big loophole in international law they've never heard of.
Well, Putin has made it very explicit. He said, quote, we will not allow it, end quote. And they are in a position, you know, they have the high cards, as I said before. They have the high geographic, strategic, economic. They have all kinds of high cards there. And I can only, you know, I suspect that for the likes of Victoria Nuland and some of these Dr. Strangelove characters we have in the military, that they'd just as soon have a little outburst of hostilities, not even considering the escalation that could lead to, and the dangers for a really hot war as well as a cold war once again with Russia.
Yeah. Well, and that's the real thing of it, too, is that especially going back to the Nazis here, is that these are guys who we've outsourced a lot of our decision making to them, not just to Poroshenko and the parliament, but these independent militias who, you know, walk around with their 88s and 14s and SS lightning bolts and swastikas and praising Hitler and all this kind of stuff, and you know, make it very plain who they are. And they're just the exact wrong kind of party that you want in a situation like this. Not only are we messing around with you know, Russia's backyard, quote unquote, so to speak, sphere of interest, their most important neighboring nation, but we're doing so with complete wild cards in the deck here, and of course H bombs at the ready.
Yeah, it's not a pretty picture. I would hope that Angela Merkel and Hollande, who have a big stake in this now, they're part of Minsk, right? I would hope that they would lean on Poroshenko, because I don't think Washington is. Maybe the president wants to, but maybe he'd have to ask Mother May I to Victoria Nuland. They need to tamp this thing down because Nazi, they should have a little bit of experience with what happens when fascism takes over, right? And they need to just step up and play a bigger role.
All right. With that, I'll let you go. Thanks very much for coming back on the show, Ray. Appreciate it.
Most welcome.
All right, y'all. That's the great Ray McGovern, veteran intelligence professional for Sanity, a regular writer at consortiumnews.com, and check out his everything at raymcgovern.com. That's it for the show. Overtime. See you tomorrow.